Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another episode of Your Case is on Hold, number 64. For the middle of August, I just want to say that all the opinions are our own and do not represent the JBJS board or any other people affiliated with JBJS. I am Antonia Chen. I am deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction, and I have here...
I am Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods.
And we are here and brought to you by JBJS CME. So get your CME on, get your learn on, lots of different things on JBJS. Go to the website. Check it out, and there's a lot of good information there. Without further ado, we're going to talk about the honorable mentions, what is new in limb lengthening and deformity correction by BAFOR.
This is top of the pile. It's top of the pile, actually.
Oh, top of the pile. My fault.
Yeah. No, that's my fault, actually. Nonetheless, it's all good. They know what we're talking about.
We know what's there, and it's good stuff.
Yeah.
We have three evidence-based orthopedic articles, The Role of Sex and Gender in Transgender Bone and Other Musculoskeletal Health by Graves, Influence of Sex and Gender on Musculoskeletal Conditions and How They Are Reported by TOSI, and Plates and Screws May Fix My Bones and Titanium Should Never Hurt Me by Bitterman, which is permanently free.
That's intriguing.
That is very intriguing. I like that sticks and stones may break my bones analogy there. So it's pretty cool. Definitely want to check that out. We also have Medicare's post-acute care reimbursement models as of 2023, past, present, and future by Siddiqui. And then AOA Critical Issue Symposium, Promoting Healthy Equity by Kentor. Without further ado, now we're going to go into our headlines. Dr. Schoenfeld, please tell us about the mortality, analgesic use, and care requirements after vertebral compression fractures, a retrospective cohort study of 18,392, specifically that number, older adult patients by Honda et al. With a visual summary, and it is permanently free.
Yeah, so you don't have to just take my word for it. You can check out the article yourself at no charge and draw your own conclusions. It is a very specific number. It's a large number. The number is coming from claims data among older adults with vertebral compression fractures treated in the suburban prefecture in the greater Tokyo area. So it's claims data on patients over the age of 65 diagnosed with a vertebral compression fracture over a five-year time window, essentially 2014 to 2019. These are based on ICD codes, and then the authors looked at the number of patients who died within a year, factors associated with prolonged analgesic use, you know, a couple of different factors. I think overall, we are appreciating that vertebral compression fractures do have a more dramatic impact on quality of life, survival, and overall function than they may have previously been appreciated, at least in the general medical sense. That includes everything that we're measuring here in terms of survival, need for analgesics, or patients just becoming reliant on analgesics for, you know, chronic pain needs after they have this vertebral fracture that can, in a way that hip fractures or odontoid fractures have previously been recognized to, create a foundational and fundamental shift in the trajectory of patient lives after they have an injury of this type. And then that's also particularly demonstrated through the care requirements, you know, eventually patients becoming care dependent, so to speak. Now, because this is claims-based data, it is not especially granular, and you get a lot of kind of generalities in the results of this study that I found to be somewhat unsatisfying as someone who cares for patients with vertebral compression fractures quite regularly, because, you know, it's not entirely clear in these broad brushstroke sort of euphemism, large bucket sort of designations. For example, pre-existing care dependency. Well, I mean, what does that mean exactly? There's probably a wide range of variation in what exactly constitutes a pre-existing care dependency. And these types of individuals were actually the ones who are most likely to experience functional decline following vertebral fractures. So, of course, it goes without saying, they probably had more limited physiologic reserve to begin with. Maybe they were just making do and then they have this fracture that sets them back and they can't ever get back to their baseline after taking that hit to their physiologic reserve. Especially when we're talking about spine fractures, they can be very painful. They can cause patients to become very sedentary. And even if it's just for a matter of a few weeks, let alone a few months, that can create a dramatic amount of loss in terms of their muscle atrophy, functional tolerance, ability to tolerate even normal daily activities. That's kind of the difference when you're talking about spine fractures versus, even hip fractures or some other type of extremity fracture. You fix that fracture, it is painful for a while, but pain levels reduce, functionality returns fairly quickly. Whether or not surgery is done for spine fractures
will just allow for natural history to occur in terms of the healing of the fractures. So they will still be painful. And this just results in the patients continuing to have issues in mobility that just has to be borne out as the time transpires for the fractures to heal. I will say the interesting finding is about the 5% mortality within 1 year. We've done some studies a little bit broader in terms of the scope and outlook using Mass General Brigham data and have found a higher rate of mortality, to be frank, than just the 5%. I think this can result from a couple of different factors. One being the fact that this is using codes. Sometimes codes are used to support imaging studies. Sometimes fractures are recognized and they're no longer actually acute fractures, which may have an impact on the near-term effects that they have on survival. It could be that this population has a lower number of comorbidities. I didn't see in the work itself that those were especially well characterized. So these are all factors that could influence that difference in terms of the estimate, which was quite a bit higher. But these are just also vertebral compression fractures that are probably all insufficiency fractures, whereas again, ours was a broader cohort of patients with wider age groups, although we did do subset analysis based on age, but potentially including more severe fractures as well. Overall, an interesting study, large number of patients. I do think there is value here.
Not opposed to it. This is not on hold. Your case is proceeding. I'm going to flip things a little bit, and now I'm going to talk about tibial base plate migration is not associated with change in patient-reported outcome measures and clinical scores after total knee arthroplasty. A secondary analysis of 5 radiosymmetric analysis studies with 10-year follow-up. By Vanderlege, there's a commentary on it, and it's also permanently free. So the idea here is that we have incrementally used PROMs more and more in our workflow, right? We're getting it preoperatively and postoperatively. PROMs used to be just a research metric. Now we're getting it in our patients on a more regular basis in a clinical setting. But we really don't understand well what affects patient outcomes. There's a lot of studies that have shown correlations, but not as many from a radiographic standpoint. This is a study that specifically looked at RSA, which is this radiostereodometric analysis. It's a highly accurate and objective method to potentially detect implant migration. So it can detect even small amounts like 0.1 millimeters and 0.2 millimeters, as opposed to if you're looking just an x-ray and looking for subsidence, it's really hard to detect really small changes. This is typically true during the early follow-up when there could be some migration or subsidence before stabilization. And it is associated with implant revision risk. So the aim of the study was to evaluate the association between tibial implant migration and changes in postoperative PROMs and clinical scores using data pooled from long-term follow-up RSA studies. While the patients state that this could potentially take the place of clinic visits and reduce costs, they mentioned that in the introduction, there's really a need to implant the beads used for RSA, you need to have radiographic follow-up, you need to have a specialist analyze it. That requires an in-person visit to some sort of radiographic facility, so there's a cost there. For someone to interpret RSA, there's a cost there, the cost of the beads, and following up patients over time. So I wouldn't say that the point of the RSA is to take over clinical visits. But it can potentially look at early signs of loosening or implant problems and need for revision risk. The study of note only evaluated the tibial base plate and did not take the femoral component into evaluation. So it was a tibial base plate only study in total knee arthroplasty. Individual implant migration data were collected from 5 randomized RSA studies from a single institution. So this place has done long-term follow-up on these patients. And each study was a randomized controlled trial using RSA to assess differences in migration between 2 total knee implant designs. Now, the implants were of various different designs. They were all from one company. So they looked at, for example, cemented versus cementless, CR versus PS, whether or not there was a short keel or not. There were 300 patients included in the study with 6 distinct total knee arthroplasty implant designs. And tibial implant migration, also known as the maximum total point migration, was evaluated with RSA on the first day after surgical procedure when weight bearing was achieved, and then at 3 months, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 7 years, and 10 years postoperatively. These were done with the patient laying in a supine position and a knee in a calibration cage. So you also need a calibration cage in order to see these images and to be able to compare them over time. Migration was calculated using marker-based analysis with 8 tantalum beads with a diameter of 0.8 millimeters, and then were inserted into the tibial bone, and 5 beads were inserted into the polyethylene insert. And the same experienced RSA analyst performed the migration calculations in all studies using all available markers at each follow-up that could be matched to the baseline RSA image. The Knee Society score and the Knee Society function and the Knee Society function score weight and the KOOS subscales were collected in all studies at the same time frames. They use linear mixed effect models with adjustment for total knee arthroplasty implant design and patient characteristics. The 3-month follow-up was used as the baseline to assess the association between the implant migration and PROMs across the 10-year follow-up. And during the 10-year follow-up, 7 implants were revised because of infection, component loosening was 2, instability was 1, or insert wear was 2. At the 10-year follow-up, RSA migration data were available for 163 patients, which was only 54.3%. Now, it's 10 years is a good long amount of time, which is great, but it had only about half the population. Of note, the CR uncemented porous-coated total knee arthroplasty implant had the highest absolute migration. Now, note that this is looking at the tibial tray. So the fact that it's CR versus PS means different stresses are placed to the system. But remember, we're looking at only the tibia. We're not looking at the femur. So this CR uncemented porous-coated total knee arthroplasty had the highest absolute migration at 1.84 versus CR cemented, PS cemented, short-keeled, or CR uncemented PA-coated implants, which ranged, you know, under 1. There was no association between tibial implant migration and change in Knee Society score knee or Knee Society score function, KOOS symptoms, KOOS pain, KOOS activities of daily living, KOOS sports and recreation, or KOOS quality of life across the entire follow-up up to 10 years. There were similar results found when using the 2-year follow-up as a baseline, after which both cemented and cementless implants were expected to have stabilized by that point. These are somewhat interesting findings, and because it's always good to see RSA and see it being followed up for a long period of time, but there really was no correlation with patient-reported outcomes. So the take-home message from the authors were saying, look, there's more that we could do with the study, but the point of RSA is to evaluate hardware and implant bone fixation rather than patient report outcomes, which measure something different, such as patient perception and clinical scores. I wish there were more implant systems evaluated. There was just one company included here. I wish there was a larger patient series, but it's obviously hard to do given the long-term follow-up of these studies as well, too. And I wish there was a way that you could either look at PROMs or other modalities to predict when a patient would fail, being like, okay, all these patients failed. What about them in the earlier stage would have indicated that they were going to fail and you could potentially intervene earlier? So an early detection thing can be really good, but at the 10-year mark, there's not a lot, I would say. So it's hard to take these RSA studies and it's stretching it a little bit and trying to bring in the PROMs factor of it. But RSA is a cool technique and obviously is able to detect minute changes in the implant and the bone.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting study. It's an interesting paradigm, litany of like outcome data, just a torrent of outcome data. But at the end of the day, you know, I would put it to you you to answer this question, but I'm interested in your take on it. My take is that I can't conceivably see where there's like a clinical impact for this. Like, what's the clinical take home? How does this apply to clinical practice? I think it's more just like, look at all the stuff we can do. And these are all the various associations. Do with it what you will.
That's how I felt about it too. You know, it's like they said, hey, look, we have all this great data. We have 10 years of data. We showed how much migration there was, but that's not exciting. So let's try to correlate it to a clinical finding. And it didn't, which is probably not surprising. Like if I tell a patient, you subsided by 1 millimeter, they're going to look at me and they go, what? I don't think that's going to affect their outcome scores. So from a clinical perspective, I agree with you. And this is why RSA is not widely adopted, right? It's not like every single person is going to go put beads in and then follow up these patients with these, you know, special cages and special things. It's just, it's too much unless you're doing it from a research only perspective. So I agree with you. Moving on, we got something else going on for us. Our next topic is going to be aseptic revision, total hip arthroplasty using modular fluted tapered stems, long-term follow-up of 515 cases. This is the Your Cases on Hold featurette by Carinder et al. And this is brought to you by our friends at Mayo Clinic. So I've covered total knees in one. Now I got to cover total hips in the other one. More surgeons have used modular fluted tapered femoral stems in aseptic total hip arthroplasty revisions, but the long-term data is lacking using the stem. So this is a follow-up study from a previous study that had 519 aseptic revision total hip arthroplasties using a modular fluted taper stem at a mean follow-up of 4.5 years, demonstrating a 10-year survivorship free of stem revisions for aseptic loosening of 98%. We have lost 4 cases. That's what this update's about. The purpose of the study was to update this previous series with a mean of 10-year follow-up with specific emphasis on implant survivorship, radiographical results, and complications in a large cohort of aseptic revision total hip arthroplasties using these types of stems. This was from 1999 to 2013. This is the incredible Mayo Registry. There were 5,643 aseptic revision total hip arthroplasties performed by 16 surgeons. The 4 hips that were excluded that went from the 5-year follow-up average to 10-year follow-up decided to opt out of research participation altogether. The remaining, amazingly, still opted in. Clinical radiographic follow-up was routinely offered at 6 weeks, 3 months, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, and every 5 years afterwards. Prior to the 2-year follow-up, 23 of the patients underwent revisions and were included in all analyses, and 12 patients died. An additional 20 patients had less than 2 years of follow-up and were considered lost to follow-up. Among the remaining 460 patients who were alive and had not gone a revision, the mean follow-up was 10 plus or five, minus 5 years with a range of 2 to 21 years. These 515 aseptic femoral revisions were performed with 2 different modular fluted taper stems, and they had this registry at a single institution, which we know well and has published a lot. Patients who received one type of stem had greater bone loss, and the selection of stem was at the discretion of the surgeon. Serial radiographs were reviewed for subsidence of greater than 5 millimeter failure and loosening. An unrevised stem was considered loose if it demonstrated progressive subsidence, axial translation, on serial radiographs or if radiolucent lines greater than 1 millimeter wide were present around the fluted tapered component. The mean radiographic follow-up was 9 plus or minus 4 years, with a range of 0 to 20 years. A range of 0 to 20 years is a little concerning since they're putting this out there as a long-term follow-up. And so the last case was in 2013. So if there were 0 years of follow-up, that's very concerning. That said, you really can't account for subsidence, really, if they had no years of follow-up and you couldn't see subsidence because there wasn't more than one radiograph because it was in the first year time. Something to think about. A competing risk model accounted for death was utilized, and a 15-year cumulative index of any revision was the finding in the study, and that was 12%. There were a total of 57 revisions performed. 27 revisions involved revision or removal of the fluted taper component, resulting in a 15-year cumulative incidence of any fluted taper component revision of 6%. The most common reasons for revision were dislocation, periprosthetic joint infection, and aseptic loosening of this fluted taper component. Not surprising, that's true for most hips. It's dislocation and periprosthetic joint infection. They then separated it, and this is what their conclusion take-home message was the 15-year cumulative index of revision of the FTC for aseptic loosening was 2%. It happened in 3 cases with type 3A bone, 2 cases with type 3B bone, and 6 cases with type 4 bone, which is the worst. So it's not surprising that the aseptic loosening happened when you had the worst type of bone. A total of 75 reoperations were performed, and the 15-year cumulative index for any reoperation was 16%. So now I want to talk to you about stem subsidence. So they said stem subsidence was greater than 5 millimeters. Stem subsidence of greater than 5 millimeters occurred in 11 unrevised cases, which is 2%. At a mean clinical and radiographic follow-up of 10 plus or minus 3 years, here the range is a little better from 5 to 14 years, 10 of the 11 stems that subsided were radiographically stable. They said no further subsidence on steroid radiographs and had no radiographic signs of loosening. One stem continued to subside and had a progressive radiolucent lines of greater than 1 millimeter wide circumferentially around the stem. It was deemed loose, but it was not revised secondary to medical comorbidities of the patient. Interestingly, the authors report that among the stems that subsided, the mean amount of subsidence was 16 millimeters with a range from 6 to 29 millimeters. To me, that's a lot of subsidence. 16 millimeters is 1.6 centimeters, and they were not revised. Obviously, it's for a variety of reasons, whether you consider it aseptic loosening, but they weren't considered because they weren't in that cohort. Anyway, that's a lot. Complications, intraoperative femoral fractures occurred in 13% of cases. 63 fractures involved the femoral diaphysis and 5 fractures involved the greater trochanteric region. These were non-operatively treated postoperative complications occurred in 84 cases, which is 16%. I do like studies that have longer follow-up. I like to encourage researchers to do as much follow-up as possible. And it's really good. We like to see as much long-term data, recognizing that we can't always get that. Now, to only lose 4 patients in almost a 5-year mean time frame, that's pretty good. But that's the benefit of living in the Midwest, potentially, and that patients will come back for their follow-up. But I do worry about people who, again, we talked about this in a previous episode, where if you just jump to the conclusion, it says that, you know, the large series of modular fluted taper stems used in aseptic revision total hepatoplasty had a 2% incidence of subsequent revision of the FTC for aseptic loosening at 15 years. And again, the range was from 0 to 21. And dislocation infection were the most common reason for any revision, which I don't have a problem with. But we do have to interpret it with caution, given their different definitions. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, look, I'm not going to, at the end of the day, you can't critique this study for being what it is, which is a registry work. The critique is not so much for the study itself as it is a caution around what are you going to do with this information? How are you going to apply it to your clinical practice? Is it even applicable to your clinical practice? And I can't answer that for any one individual who's looking to use this. The Mayo Registry is obviously well known, internationally recognized. It has tremendous number of patients. It has extensive follow-up, all of which you just identified and which is advertised here in this particular paper. Let's talk about the fact the realities are that this goes back to 1999. And, there's no way to account for secular trends. There's also no way to account, and you covered it with, you know, some of these patients where it seems like, wow, the way this is described, they should probably have a revision, but maybe they didn't have a revision for whatever reason. So there's selection and indication bias, both in the decision on the implant, as you also discussed, and then the decision on if it has failed clinically, or if there are parameters around it that would indicate a failure, the decision to actually move forward with a surgery, another surgery. I think that there's only so much that you can do with registries like this. Obviously, researchers like to publish out of them, and they are attractive to readers because it's like, look at all these patients and look at all this duration of follow-up. You really probably can't replicate that in just a normal standard clinical practice, either based on the numbers, based on the duration of follow-up, based on the intention and the data collection. Only a place like Mayo Clinic and a few others that have similar characteristics can do that. So from a natural history standpoint, I think it's interesting and clear why it was accepted for publication. From a clinical application standpoint, again, I have some concerns around how this could be meaningfully applied to inform someone's clinical practice. Again, recognizing restricted clinical variation, a lot of the numbers, a lot of the event rates it's just a handful of patients. So when, there's only less than 10 patients with with type 4 bone, as you said, I don't know what that's really going to be able to tell you in terms of how to manage those individual patients beyond what is already known or surmised. That's my stance on it.
I think it's a great take, and that's why it's published, but everything with a grain of salt. So not fully on hold. All right. Moving on to the honorable mentions, talking about implant system, the Wagner cone system for atypical femoral anatomy and total hip arthroplasty, a report of 320 cases with minimum 5-year follow-up. This is by Kayani et al. There's a commentary. The use of the Wagner cone prosthesis stems in 302 patients that were included in the study with complex femoral anatomy undergoing primary total hip arthroplasty, such as developmental hip dysplasia and leg Kallsperg disease, was associated with 98.7% component survivorship, high levels of patient satisfaction, 95 out of 100, good functional outcomes based on the UCLA, WOMAC, Oxford Hip Score, and Forgotten Joint Score, and reliable osseointegration with minimal stem subsidence as seen on radiographs at intermediate term follow-up with a mean follow-up time of 10.1 years, ranging from 5.2 to 15.5 years. The next one was on anterior-posterior laxity and midflexion after posterior-stabilized total knee arthroplasty is sensitive to MCL tension in passive flexion, an in vitro biomechanics study. By Barubi et al., it was a cadaveric study in 8 knees. The MCL tensions were greater following posterior stabilized TKA than the native knee at 15 and 30 degrees of passive flexion, while the LCL tensions did not differ. Anterior laxity at 30 degrees of flexion was highly sensitive to MCL tension during passive flexion following posterior stabilized total knee arthroplasty, but not in the native knee. Meaning if the MCL tension is maintained, then this might lead to heightened anterior-posterior laxity. If you tension the MCL to supraphysiologic levels, then you might have less anterior-posterior laxity, but the trade-off is your MCL. So there is a trade-off, and that's what this cadaveric study was highlighting. The last one was optimizing muscle tendon lengths in reverse total short arthroplasty, evaluation of surgical and implant design-related parameters by Levin et al., a combination of a smaller lateralized glenosphere, a humeral socket placed at the anatomic neck plane, and an anatomic 135 neck shaft angle best restore native deltoid and rotator cuff muscle tendon lengths in reverse total shoulder arthroplasty. Thanks so much for joining us again. We always love having you guys aboard. If you have any questions or comments, you know how to reach out to us, and we hope you guys come back next week. Until then, thanks for joining.